Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Instagram propose des outils pour la famille qui permettent à vos proches de naviguer de façon raisonnable et en toute sécurité sur l'application. Quand les ados créent leur profil Instagram, les comptes privés par défaut garantissent que ce qu'ils publient n'est visible que par eux et les personnes qui les suivent. Choisir une limite quotidienne de temps aide votre ado à naviguer de façon raisonnable sur Instagram. Et paramétrer les outils de supervision ensemble vous offre une meilleure visibilité des comptes suivis par votre ado. Pour en savoir plus sur ces outils et en découvrir d'autres, rendez-vous sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 13th of June, these are our main stories. High security in Miami as Donald Trump prepares to become the first former president ever to face federal charges. Meanwhile, America's largest bank, JP Morgan Chase, settles a lawsuit brought on behalf of victims of the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And a woman in Ecuador wakes up inside a coffin at her own wake after being mistakenly declared dead. Also in this podcast, rights groups in Britain say there's a desperate need for reform after a woman is jailed for an illegal abortion. And a clever idea by the Dutch to reduce skin cancer by swapping the gel in COVID hand sanitizer dispensers with free sun cream.
Over the past 10 years, the numbers have doubled. It's very important that we prevent our young kids from sunburns because that gives a higher risk for skin cancer.
But first, Donald Trump has flown to Miami as he prepares to appear in court there to face charges that he mishandled classified documents. The first former president ever to face federal charges, he's accused of 37 criminal counts of unauthorized possession of classified material, obstruction of justice, and making false statements to law enforcement. It's the second time this year that he's been charged with a crime. An American attorney, Norman Eisen, told the BBC that the former president would face a tough time in court.
Out of the many troubles of Donald Trump, this may be his greatest legal and criminal concern. There is powerful evidence that he took national defense information, plans about military attacks on other countries, plans about how we might be attacked, information about nuclear secrets, our adversaries, our friends. He took all of that with him. There's no legal justification for doing that.
Mr. Trump has proclaimed his innocence and called for protests outside the federal courthouse during his arraignment. As the rhetoric heats up, there are rising concerns about disruption. The mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez, urged protesters to do so peacefully.
In our city, we obviously believe in the Constitution, believe that people should have the right to express themselves. But we also believe in law and order. We encourage people to be peaceful in them demonstrating how they feel. And we're going to have the adequate forces necessary to ensure that.
Meanwhile, Miami's police chief, Manuel Almirales, said the police would not hesitate to act should things get out of hand.
Make no mistake about it, we're taking this event extremely serious. We know that there is a potential of things taking a turn for the worst, but that's not the Miami way, right? I want to assure the city we are ready. We're ready for it to be over and gone.
I got the latest on the mood in Miami from our North America correspondent, Nomir Iqbal.
Well, here outside Donald Trump's resort, where he will be spending the night before heading to court, as you can imagine, there's lots of his diehard supporters. They're carrying huge flags. Donald Trump 2024, I'll be back. There are cars that are specifically made with all this Donald Trump paraphernalia all over it. You've got motorbikers as well. Cars tooting their horn in support. Remember, Florida is a very Republican state. It's Trump's adopted home state. And so for a lot of his supporters here, they're looking forward to him being here, and they completely back his narrative that he's spinning, which is that this indictment is a political witch hunt, that this is President Biden, so he says, weaponizing the Department of Justice in order to go after him, to stop him from winning the presidential election in 2024. Sorry, it's incredibly noisy, as you can imagine. And of course, all these conspiracy theories are something his supporters really, really back. They are diehard. It's impossible to try and convince them of looking at the evidence that's been presented in this 37-count indictment.
And briefly, Nomia, meanwhile, his campaigning continues for the presidency next year.
I'd say this has catalysed the Trump campaign train. He's using it to fundraise. There's lots of questions, of course. What if he is convicted and so forth? Can he still hold office? That's a big question. But he can legally still run for the Republican nomination.
That was the BBC's Nomia Iqbal. The Sudanese capital Khartoum has been the centre of fierce battles since an internationally brokered truce between the warring generals came to an end. On Sunday, the army claimed to have retaken a strategic bridge, but much of the city remains under the control of the RSF. They're the paramilitary forces loyal to Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. Mohamed Gibril is a doctor and medical researcher based in the capital. He gave a vivid description of what's happening in his neighbourhood to Tim Franks.
There's a routine sounds of bombing and of a plane cruising over our heads. Bullets are normalized. You don't even notice that they are being shot. They are usually random bullets of RSF members. The area that I live in has been occupied totally by the Arab Support Force units from the first day of the 15th of April. So it totally belongs to them. What I hear and what I see is them cruising in the street, taking and hijacking cars. I have not left the block that I live in since the start of 15th of April.
Good grief. So you've really had to sort of shut down your life pretty much then. Have you managed to stay out of the way of the fighters?
It always comes to a personal experience. You have probabilities. So there's a probability that a projectile missile to fall on the house. There is also a probability of being shot. And there's also a probability of being stopped by RSF members and being shot at the site. And there's a probability of being raided inside your house and being a victim of assault.
And the biggest has that happened to you?
The last one has happened to me. It's the last Monday at this time. So I was at home, and when our neighbors left their house, they left their cars in the yard of our house. We have like a house with a yard. It attracts. When you look at it, you'd think that these folks have money. So I was expecting them to loot at any time our house. I was at home, and then I started hearing knocking on the door. I saw members of the RSF at the door. So I went and opened the door. They pointed their AK-47 at me, and whose house is this? Sit down, don't make a move. I was like, this is my house. Five of them were armed by RSF. They were very formal RSF members, but apparently they were recently recruited and recently made it to the capital. Alongside them, there were five, let's call them kids, who lived in Khartoum their whole life, but I did not have a chance in getting a good life. And they relate to the RSF members by blood, so it was easier for the RSF member to recruit children and people from the hoods around the rich folks area, let's call it. The oldest one of them was 21, and the youngest was 13. They told me to sit down, and they started hitting me. I was like, you don't need to hit me. I know that you need the cars from inside, and you can come inside and take the cars. You don't need to take my life for a car. After a series of half an hour of gunshot being shot at my foot and being threatened to death, they took a car and they left. 5 minutes later, another group came, and these men were very brutal. They spent a lot of time with me. They wanted the keys of the cars, but I didn't have keys for any car. So they started hitting me and threatening me and taking over my phone and replying for my father and my family that we are going to kill this person unless you send $2 billion to this account. And I had to talk my way out. It's like a whole Orwellian thing. These kids, to me, has been brainwashed and being told that their money and their life is being taken by the people in Khartoum. And when you join this group, you're going to take their own money. They are very troubled. They are very young. They were not military trained to take a hostage. They were pointing their gun at me, and I was like, shoot me, but know that I forgive you, and even my father will forgive you, because this whole country is a mess and has damaged a lot of people, including you and me as well. So just do your thing. He changed his mind and he decided not to kill me. They took everything, the phones, computer, laptops. I even gave them books in order to spare my life.
Mohammed, it sounds like the most appalling ordeal that you had to live through. And it also sounds amazing the way in which you dealt with it, that you had a cool enough head to somehow be able to talk your way out of the trouble. I have to ask you whether you think that you'll stay.
My first priority is to go to a place where I find a job and be able to make an income. I'm a physical doctor, so this would typically mean hospital. There is no life in this place, no whatsoever, especially for people my age who are promised a lot of opportunities. I don't think I'll stay because I will probably find a job next week, but it's a very personal case.
That was Mohammed Gabriel talking to the BBC's Tim Franks. The West's military support for Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia's occupying forces has been crucial. World leaders are hoping that the billions of dollars they've given to Kyiv will translate to victories on the battlefield. The Ukrainian military says it's retaken more than half a dozen villages, but Russia says it's fought back, repelling attacks around some of them. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said he hoped a successful counteroffensive would bring President Putin to the negotiating table. And he stressed that American backing for Ukraine wouldn't waver.
We'll continue to maximize our support to Ukraine now so that it can have success on the battlefield. But also, our enduring support is critical. Support for Ukraine so that it can build up over time a strong deterrent and defense capacity for its military, so that in the future, if Russia tries to pursue another aggression, it has the chance to deter that and, if necessarily, effectively defend against it.
Well, with more on the counteroffensive, James Waterhouse sent this report from the east of Ukraine.
The rolling crumps of artillery are both audible and at odds with the more immediate birdsong. After 6 months of a relative deadlock, Ukraine and its allies were greeted with a welcome sight. Ukrainian soldiers once again hoisting the country's flag in a liberated settlement, this time in Stolojeve in the Donetsk region. Glory, glory to the Marine infantry, they shout. One soldier, going by the name of Doc, described the fight to take the village.
The operation started at around 5 in the morning. We deployed from our armoured vehicles and started to charge. The enemy showed resistance, tried to push us down with the artillery, but we managed to break the initiative.
There's been no official acknowledgement of retreat by Moscow, but on Russia's National Day, Vladimir Putin has appealed for patriotism on what he described as a difficult time for his nation. As far as Ukraine's former president, Petro Poroshenko, is concerned, today is just the start of its counteroffensive.
This is a difficult job because Russia is still very, very strong. But this is a success. This is only one piece of the possible offensive operation of Ukraine.
What we will hear less about is where Ukrainian progress has been slower or non-existent. In the southern Zaporizhia region in particular, a lot of men and equipment have been lost as Kyiv tries to probe for a weakness, and neither side has deployed their main forces yet. When Kyiv decides to, it'll hope it brings more than just the liberation of villages.
That report by James Waterhouse. The American sex offender and former financier Jeffrey Epstein was accused of running a vast network of underage girls who were abused for sex. His crimes were all the more frightening because of his close links to some of the most powerful and wealthiest elites in New York. Among them, JP Morgan Chase, that's America's biggest bank, which has agreed to pay up to $290 million to settle a lawsuit by Epstein's victims. It's accused of assisting and profiting from Epstein's crimes by enabling him to make payments. He killed himself in prison in 2019 while facing further charges. I heard more from our New York business correspondent, Samira Hussein.
Jeffrey Epstein was a client of J.P. Morgan Chase's between 1998 and 2013, and it is during that time that he was trafficking many women and girls. In this particular lawsuit, the victim alleged that the bank repeatedly ignored red flags because it valued him as a wealthy client and also valued the people in his circle. And what the lawsuit also alleges is that even after Jeffrey Epstein was registered as a sex offender after an offense in 2008 in Florida in which he solicited sex from an underage individual, the bank still continued to do business with him. And that all of that business with him really allowed the bank to both assist and profit from Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking ring, because they allowed him to make payments to women for sex acts. And of course, they profited from those payments.
This case, like you say, brought by a victim, but on behalf of numerous others. How many people were involved in this class action lawsuit, and how will they be compensated?
So this lawsuit was brought by one person that is being named as Jane Doe, and she said she was sexually abused by Epstein from 2006 to 2013 and trafficked to his friends. Now, the bank was trying to push back on the number of victims. There is a threshold in New York for class action lawsuits, and they were saying there were only about 32 victims. Well, the judge has said, well, look, there are more than 40 victims, and now there are estimates of over 100 women that could benefit from this class action lawsuit. In a statement, the bank said it regrets any association with Mr. Epstein and that it would never have continued to do business with him if it believed that he was using the bank to help commit their heinous crimes. And they went on to say that they understand that Epstein's behavior was monstrous, and we believe that the settlement is in the best interest of all parties, especially the survivors who suffered unimaginable abuse at the hands of this man.
That was Samira Hussein. A woman in Ecuador has woken up inside a coffin at her own wake after being mistakenly declared dead 2 days earlier. The unusual incident has been widely reported in Ecuador, with headlines celebrating what they called the woman's resurrection. Amelia Clark has more.
It's the kind of scenario that could fuel nightmares. Bea Montoya, who's 76, was taken to a hospital in the city of Babahoyo last week with a suspected stroke. There, she went into cardiac arrest, and doctors said their attempts to resuscitate her failed. Her family were given a death certificate, and they went about sourcing the donation of a coffin for their impoverished relative. But the woman's son told local media that 5 hours into the wake, the assembled mourners heard her beating against the coffin. A video posted online shows the woman, whose departure they'd been marking, lying inside the box, breathing heavily as two men try to help her. The country's health ministry has said it is investigating, while Ms. Montoya is receiving treatment at the same hospital that declared her dead on Friday.
A remarkable story. Amelia Clark there. Still to come on the Global News podcast, why Colombia is considering introducing the Swahili language from East Africa in its schools.
During the slavers made us to forget our languages from Africa. In Colombia, we have 15 million people of African descent. It's the beginning of that bond we want to create.
Italian politics has been transfixed by news of the death of the former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi at the age of 86. His state funeral will be held in Milan Cathedral on Wednesday, when a day of national mourning will also be observed. Mr. Berlusconi was one of the dominant figures in Italian political and business life, and still a senator in the governing coalition until his death. The Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, led the tributes to Mr. Berlusconi, calling him one of the most influential men in Italy's history. On the streets in Rome, there was a mixed reaction to the news.
He'd become a totally marginal figure in politics and in society, but he was still a part of our history.
Look, as far as I'm concerned, he is a negative part of our political life, so I'm not sure how bad it is that he's died. But I do think his party will be strongly destabilised by this.
He was a peculiar man, I guess even funny as he was representing a country, but he had his own way to be ironic. I do feel sorry, as it's a life ending.
Our correspondent Bethany Bell is in Rome.
There's been huge numbers of tributes flooding in for this very controversial and polarising figure who really dominated Italian politics for very, very many years. We heard from the Italian Prime Minister, who said he was a very influential person in Italian history. We heard very interestingly, from the former Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi and a political rival. And he said many hated him, many loved him, but nobody could deny the unprecedented impact he'd had on Italian life, political, economic, television, sport, you name it. Incredibly influential figure.
Now, like you say, he dominated Italian politics, an unprecedented impact. What will his impact be then on Italian politics, his passing? Because he was still a senator.
And his party, his Forza Italia party, is a member of Italy's right-wing coalition, a junior party. There are questions being asked about what will happen to Forza Italia. Because Berlusconi had dominated the party for so long, it was very much tied up with his charismatic leadership, and its support has dwindled as he faced health challenges. And the question is, will his MPs decide to stay with Forza Italia, or will they move to the party, say, of the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni? Or the other possibility some people are speculating about is, will a member of Berlusconi's own family take over the political party?
The voice there of Bethany Bell. In our podcast yesterday, we reported on the desperate situation in Haiti, where armed gangs control much of the capital. Kidnappings are widespread and more than 600 people were killed in April alone. Well, the country's political leaders are in Jamaica to try and find a way out of the chaos that's enveloped the Caribbean nation over the last 2 years. They were invited to Jamaica by the Prime Minister of the Bahamas, Philip Davis, who's the chair of the regional CARICOM Group of Nations. He spoke to James Cobnall.
The problem is that it's a failed state at the moment. They have no legitimately elected government. They have an interim government that we are recognizing because this is the closest regime to legitimate government, and that is the present acting prime minister, Henry Ariel. And the challenge is that the gangs have taken over most of the strategic institutions in Haiti, and the violence that's permeating the country, fear of violence that's obviously existing, does not lend itself to free and fair elections occurring at any time now. And so the idea is to seek to get all of the leaders of the political parties and influential NGOs to come together to create a path for peaceful elections and for support to be given to strengthen the Haitian National Police with recruitment, resources, and training, and strengthening them up to create what I call a space for peace, to allow for those who would like to participate in the election to do so without fear of violence.
But isn't part of the problem that the entire political class almost is seen by Haitians as corrupt, as part of the problem and not part of a potential solution? A tough obstacle to overcome, isn't it?
Well, that perception does exist, and that is part of our challenge. We have to start somewhere. And unfortunately, I think in most jurisdictions you'll find that people believe that the politicians are corrupt in some form or fashion, even in the UK. That's the cynical thinking of the electorate today. But in Haiti, it's perhaps more entrenched there because of the challenges and the suffering that the people are experiencing.
It also occurs to me that the history of outside interventions in Haiti over centuries, really, but even down to United Nations missions in recent times, has been a very tragic one. And yet, if you're talking about setting up a situation in which peaceful elections are going to take place in a climate where right now gangs seem to be in control of most of the capital, at least, it will require, presumably, some sort of outside intervention for that to happen.
We're hoping that that would not have to happen. We're trying to ensure that the solution is what I call a Haitian solution that the Haitian people could buy into. And one of the messages that I will be conveying to the leaders who come is that if they are unable to do it, then of course they will have not just outside intervention, but it may require occupation, because I don't think the world is just going to sit idly by and watch the slaughtering of the Haitian people by any group or entities on the earth.
Occupation is a very strong word.
It's a strong word, and nothing that I embrace at all. But I don't know that we could just sit by idly and watch a group of persons being killed and destroyed.
That was the Bahamian Prime Minister Philip Davis speaking to James Cobnall. A British woman has been jailed for more than 2 years for taking abortion pills after the legal limit. Carla Foster, a mother of three, lied to obtain abortion pills through the post during the COVID lockdown. A court in the city of Stoke-on-Trent heard she was between 32 and 34 weeks pregnant when she took them. The legal limit in Britain is 24 weeks. The sentence has sparked outcry among women's rights organisations and campaigners who say it's based on an archaic law. Joe Black reports.
The court heard that Carla Foster, who became pregnant in 2019, was sent abortion-causing drugs by the British Pregnancy Advisory Service after she called them during lockdown in May 2020 and lied about how far along in her pregnancy she was. Based on her answers, it was determined she was only around 7 weeks pregnant and she was sent pills in the post. Days later, a 999 call was made saying she was in labour. Her child was born during the course of the call. The baby was not breathing and, despite attempts by paramedics, was pronounced dead at hospital around 45 minutes later. The cause of death was recorded as stillbirth and maternal use of abortion drugs. Carla Foster was handed a 28-month sentence. She will serve 14 months in custody and the remaining time on licence after her release.
Joe Black there. The Colombian government is exploring teaching Swahili, the widely spoken language in East Africa, in its schools. It follows the recent trip of Colombia's Vice President, Francia Marquez, to East Africa, including Kenya. She says the move will help Afro-Colombians reconnect with their roots. Some 10% of the country is black, with many of those being able to trace their roots back to the slave trade. Victoria Unhunda spoke to Liliana Valencia, a poet, lecturer and journalist in Colombia, who accompanied the vice president on her trip. She's also of Afro-Colombian heritage herself.
The idea is to have an African language, in the case of the Swahili language, one language with a lot of speakers in Africa that can start to be teached in Colombia, not only in public schools, but in the universities also. In that moment, I was working with the vice president of Colombia, Francia Márquez, as a press officer. In the moment, I'm not working with her anymore. I went with her in the trip, and we went to three particular countries, South Africa, Kenya, and Ethiopia. So when we went to Kenya, we started to talk about how to create that kind of bonds in terms of identity, in terms of culture, in terms of economical growth. And one of the options was exactly learning Swahili in Colombia. I think it's important because, first of all, the cultural exchange, but also because here in the diaspora, we as African, we want to recreate our identity. We want to wear African fabrics. We want to go to Africa with direct flights. We want to have visas in Africa, and also, why not, to learn an African language.
And so how significant is it then for Afro-Colombians about this move?
I think for Afro-Colombian people, it's very important because we feel we are recreating our identity. You know, during the slavery, the slavers actually made us to forget our languages from Africa. So in Colombia, we have 15 million people of African descent. And I can't tell you that every single black person in Colombia wants to learn Swahili. Of course not. But it's the beginning of that bond we want to create, in particular with Kenya, but also with countries like Tanzania and other countries where people are speaking Swahili. This is just the result of a first conversation between the Minister of Education of Colombia and the Minister of Education of Kenya. And they have to take the time to create a plan and to do it in the future. For the moment, it's just an idea. But I think it's a very good idea to promote cultural exchanges and identity reinforcement of Afro-Colombian people in our region.
And why is it so important for people like yourself, Afro-Colombians, and others to reclaim that culture, that identity, that bond with Africa?
In my case, I want to talk about me, for example. I took my DNA test to know exactly where my genes are come from. And in my case, they are from Gabon and Sierra Leone. But it's just an example to tell you that there's a lot of people like myself trying to identify where we come from, to learn an African language, to go and travel, to go and visit more countries we can in Africa, to come back from that trips and talk with the people in Colombia to say, we are actually Africans of the diaspora. We have a motherland. We are not just slaves. We are descendants of people that actually work to create this new world. And to me, that's the base of fighting against racism. I think it's very important to create that bridge, create that bond with Africa, to understand who we are right now, where we come from, and where are we wanting to go as a community.
That was Liliana Valencia there. People in the Netherlands are being offered free suntan lotion this summer in an attempt to reduce the numbers of people getting skin cancer. They're converting hand sanitizing stations left over from the COVID pandemic and filling them with sunscreen. It's being organized by the government, but there are also local initiatives, including one organized by a dermatologist, Karen van Poppelen. She's aiming to provide 120 primary schools with sunscreen and told Owen Bennett-Jones why the initiative is so important.
In the past few years, we had a big increase in the incidence of skin cancer. Over the past 10 years, the numbers have doubled. The main cause of the skin cancer are sunburns. And it's very important that we prevent our young kids from sunburns, because that gives a higher risk for skin cancer.
There is a sort of feeling amongst some children is that it's, you know, not a cool thing to do. Would that be fair?
The Dutch kids are the same. They don't really like using sunscreen either. So it's sticky and they don't really like it. But we also gave them a teaching program about the sun.
It takes many years before the skin cancer develops, presumably. I mean, what's the typical age that someone would suffer from it?
Well, the biggest group is like 40 years and older.
Yeah.
But we also see, especially with melanoma skin cancer, people in their 20s. So we advise our kids to repeat it every 2 hours. So it needs to be a habit. But we also advise to look for the shade and wear like sun protective clothes.
Is there something funny about the price of sunscreen? It's very, very expensive in the shops. And I just wonder if it's that hard to make.
Well, I think the price of the sunscreens vary a lot. But the cheaper sunscreen from the local supermarket gives the same protection. But the prices are really high. We work together with health insurance and local authorities. And I think that's the beauty of our campaign, that everyone sees how important it is to start this prevention at early age.
Well, there's that and your brilliant idea of putting them in all the hand sanitizers that are lying around there.
When COVID got less and less, we had all these hand sanitizers here without any use. So we rebuilt them with the sunscreen on it, yeah.
And have you got children? And do they use sunscreen? And what happens when they don't?
I have two kids and they are really good. My son will put his sunscreen on before I even told him.
Really?
He's really good with it. My daughter doesn't really like it, but when I ask, she definitely will do it. Hmm. And we have this slogan in the Netherlands, in Dutch, it's smeren, kleren, weren. And they will repeat it to me to tell me what they're doing.
That was the dermatologist Karen van Poppelen there. Oh, and that slogan that Karen referred to translates to apply sunscreen, wear clothes and seek shade. That's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of the Global News podcast a little later on. If you want to comment on this one or any of the topics covered in it, do send us an email. The address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, the producer, Emma Joseph, the editor, Karen Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow. Until next time, goodbye.